Birth, The Grand Division, Chapter 4. It was slightly warm for March in this city of Almaty, Kazakhstan. The snow had been gone for a while, and the normally icy wind off the mountain nothing more than a cool breeze carrying pine pollen to settle on all the cars in town. It was already dark when he returned home from driving his FedEx route. Boris was once a happy bureaucrat working in the Energy Bureau of the Soviet Union. He considered himself Russian, although actually he was of German descent. Still, the weather here was nice and the countryside was beautiful. It was a little town that had become a city. The father of apples was what the name meant. He untied his FedEx tennis shoes and wiggled his toes for the first time all day. "The apple was born here," he repeated from the old propaganda public service announcements. It must be true, because the apples are amazingly flavorful and powerful. He almost laughed out loud, thinking of all the tourists who sat on the pot for days after insatiably drinking the local apple cider. In 1991, after the states became independent, it was Kazakh businessmen educated in the U.S. that were successful in raising capital from Wall Street and developing the vast reserves in this state. Although not very populated, the people here were the hub of Soviet rocket research and energy development in the old days. Still, the Chinese were the only source for equipment needed to drill past 10,000 feet in these conditions. They overcharged for the rigs, valves, pumps, and mud handling systems, which made the entire petroleum industry grow too slowly to really make money like the developers in the West, and eventually they had to sell. Of course, the ready buyers were the Chinese, who scooped up vast producing oil fields only partially developed to their potential. The Chinese immediately discounted the equipment necessary to triple production and exported all the profits and oil to China. So he had taken a job with FedEx sorting boxes at midnight and had worked his way up to driver. "It doesn't pay so badly," he often told his Ukrainian wife of 30 years. He had once worn a suit and tie to work every day and had his beautiful house near the lake paid for. Life was good then. Kazakhstan had been stolen by global corporations that exploited the people and the land. He recalled the struggle to capitalize energy assets of Kazakhstan and the last gasps of the bureaucracy during the sale of a uranium mine in the mountains to the southwest. There were Chinese bidders, but there were also some European ones with holdings in the U.S. He remembered thinking they would get a good price and everyone would be fine for a long time. But then, out of the blue, Bill Clinton, the former president from America, flew into town aboard the private jet of a mining investor of curious background named Frank Giustra from Canada. He was a glad-hander with no experience in mining to speak of, let alone experience dealing with uranium. He really had no money other than a cleverly leveraged plan using letters of credit of questionable value. They dined with the Kazakh president, Nursultan A. Nazarbayev. Mr. Clinton expressed support for Mr. Nazarbayev's bid to head an international elections monitoring group, undercutting American foreign policy and public criticism of Kazakhstan's poor human rights record by Ms. Clinton, then a senator in New York. He recalled how un-Russian it was to speak of one's wife that way. "Babnik," he said out loud as he turned on the kitchen light. It meant ladies' man. Within days of the visit, Mr. Dristra's fledgling company, Eurasia Energy Limited, signed a preliminary deal giving it stakes in three uranium mines controlled by the state-run uranium agency, Kazatomprom. The deal stunned the other bidders, who were all experienced with deep pockets in the uranium industry. It was like some secret force handed them the sweetest deal ever. In 2007, Eurasia Limited smoothly merged with Uranium One, a South African company with assets in Africa and Australia, in what was described as a $3.5 billion transaction. It sounded like so much paper and plastic. Real wealth doesn't make deals that quickly. Usually there's a year of due diligence and dozens of public officials are bribed or otherwise convinced their careers depend on it. This deal was made so fast, it was like they all had worked for the same person. The question was, in his mind, who was this person that could steal Kazakhstan's most precious resources for pennies and then export the profits to places unknown? Soon, Uranium One began to snap up companies with assets in the United States. In April of 2007, it announced the purchase of a uranium mill in Utah and more than 38,000 acres of uranium exploration properties in four western states, followed quickly by the acquisition of the Energy Metals Corporation and its uranium holdings in Wyoming, Texas, and Utah. That deal made clear to even a FedEx driver that the powers controlling Uranium One wanted to get the U.S. over a barrel, begging for fuel for their power plants. While the United States gets one-fifth of its electrical power from nuclear plants, it produces only about 20% of the uranium it needs, and most plants have only 18 to 36 months of reserves, according to a book Boris had read by Marin Katusa called The Colder War, How the Global Energy Trade Slipped from America's Grasp. They managed to keep everything out of the press until early 2008, in the midst of Mrs. Clinton's failed presidential campaign against Barack Obama, when the New York Times published an article revealing the link between Clinton's trip and Mr. Joestra's Kazakhstan mining deal. Then it revealed that Mr. Joestra had coincidentally donated $31.3 million to Clinton's foundation within weeks of the deal closing. He described his relationship with the Clintons as motivated solely by a shared interest in philanthropy. "Holy Mother of God," he said as he opened the door to let the cat inside. "Why did no one catch this?" As if to underscore the point, 5 months later, Mr. Joestra held a fundraiser and pledged another $100 million to Clinton-Joestra Sustainable Growth Initiative. "A good bureaucrat appreciates the dog and pony show to hide the bribery," he reflected. The star-studded Friends of Frank in Toronto featured performances by Elton John and Shakira and celebrities like Tom Cruise, John Travolta, and Robin Williams, all encouraging the attendees to contribute money. He recalled that in 2015, Williams committed suicide. "Probably just a coincidence," he said to the half-empty bottle of vodka he grabbed from the cabinet. The YouTube clip said, "None of this would have been possible if Frank Joestra didn't have a remarkable combination of caring and modesty, of vision and energy and iron determination," Mr. Clinton told those gathered, adding, "I love this guy, and you should too." "Oh yeah, Mr. Bill, we love this guy," he spat as he opened the refrigerator and picked the plate of spicy meat from the top shelf. A little over a year later, Hillary Clinton became the surprise Secretary of State, and in June 2009, Uranium One stock was in freefall, down 40%. Mr. Jajkishev, the head of Kazatomprom, had just been arrested on charges that he illegally sold uranium deposits to foreign companies, including at least some of those won by Mr. Joestra's Eurasia and now owned by Uranium One. Publicly, the company claimed it was a complete misunderstanding, revealing that Eurasia had received government approval of the sale. But privately, Uranium One officials were worried they could lose their joint mining ventures. Leaked American diplomatic cables made public concerns that Mr. Jakishev's arrest was part of a Russian power play for control of Kazakh uranium assets, including Uranium One. He recalled the American embassy calling to urge Kazakh officials to please help us to save our company. Even the Canadian puke called to get Boris to lean on the government. "We want more than a statement to the press," Paul Clark, a Uranium One executive vice president, emailed to him. What the company needed was official written confirmation that the licenses were valid. Yes, perhaps they were valid, but these things take time in a Russian bureaucracy. 3 days later, a wholly owned subsidiary of Rosatom completed a deal for 17% of Uranium One. It was the deal of the century for Russian investors, and within a year, the Russian government substantially upped the ante with a generous offer to shareholders that it would give it a 51% controlling stake. Usually, the real problem was getting the American Department of State to sign off on such a deal. I remember thinking just how it was when a company controlled by the Chinese government sought a 51% stake in a tiny Nevada gold mining operation in 2009. The Washington, D.C. crime syndicate, as he liked to call them, raised concerns about the mine being too close to a military installation, but also about the potential for minerals at the site, including uranium, to come under Chinese control. The officials killed the deal, just like that. The Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States picks who gets to play and who doesn't, he grunted as he leaned over to pour some dry cat food into the stainless steel bowl. Sputnik, you are a dog. You know that, he said. The committee comprises some of the most powerful members of the president's cabinet, including the attorney general, the secretaries of treasury, defense, homeland security, commerce, and energy, and the secretary of state. Their job is to review any deal that could result in foreign control of an American business or asset deemed important to national security. Surely, the Uranium One deal was of major concern for global safety. The national security issue at stake in the Uranium One deal wasn't about nuclear weapons proliferation. The United States and Russia had for years cooperated on that front, with Russia sending enriched fuel from decommissioned warheads to Irwin, Tennessee, for conversion into reactor fuel in exchange for raw uranium. He remembered almost starving before Americans offered to buy the old warheads and sitting in warehouses all over the place. The Russians are easily winning the uranium war, and nobody's talking about it, said Mr. Katusa, who explores the implication of Uranium One deal in his book. It's not just a domestic issue, but a foreign policy issue, too. Boris was a seasoned Soviet bureaucrat with connections in the Kremlin. He recalled digging through everything he could find about this transaction. He found in securities filings that Rosatom's subsidiary, ARMS, first successfully received approval by the U.S. Foreign Investment Committee when it bought its first 17% stake in Uranium One in 2009. Boris could see the Clinton Foundation payments line up with that approval easy enough. The most striking thing he found was that when the Russians moved on controlling a 51% stake, four members of the House of Representatives signed a letter expressing concern. Two more began pushing legislation to kill the deal. Senator John Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming, where Uranium One's largest American operation was, even wrote to President Obama saying the deal would give the Russian government control over a sizable portion of America's uranium production capacity. It would give ARMS a significant stake in uranium mines in Kazakhstan, he warned. Uranium One's shareholders were also afraid of Rosatom as a Russian state giant that might be in a position to choke off the West's uranium supply, or even worse, siphon off enough yellow cake for the development of untraceable weapons of mass destruction. That deal should have been dead on arrival, said Boris as he sat down with the meat and the vodka. Boris's blood went cold when he realized the power someone very high up had applied to make sure all sides had the most dangerous weapons possible. There were thousands of terrorists who would jump at the chance to straddle a small nuclear weapon and press the button anywhere in the world. He had seen this wickedness a few times in his life. In a way, he was glad to be a FedEx driver. American agencies were no different than the hardline Soviet ones that buttered his bread for so many years. These cronies seemed anxious to not only preserve the flow of uranium to all their friends, but to keep the flow of money to the Clinton Foundation. He found a letter from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to Senator Brasso assuring him that American uranium would be preserved for domestic use, regardless of who owned it. "I wonder what idiot was talked into authoring that letter," said to his cat as it rubbed against his ankle. Cats don't bark, and they don't care when you come home. In order to export uranium from the United States, Uranium One Inc., or ARMS, would need to apply for and obtain a specific NRC license authorizing the export of uranium for use as reactor fuel, the letter said. Boris was dumbfounded as to why these officials, under the direct approval of the State Department, would want their fingerprints on this deal. It was a testament to the power and protection this network of soldiers could provide. They would stick together and cover one another, or do what all good terrorists do, commit suicide. But Boris knew the game all too well. In each case, Hillary Clinton needed to personally approve the acquisitions and the sale of uranium to Russia, while Bill Clinton collected millions in donations from people associated with Uranium One. He brazenly signed a memorandum of understanding placing limits on the activities with her foundation, which required her by law to disclose all contributors, but she failed to disclose even once Uranium One while she was Secretary of State. Boris was able to look up from the foundation's tax record. Even a junior bureaucrat could find this money trail. His cat showed only marginal interest in his discovery. She had laundered $1 million in 2009, $250,000 in 2010, $600,000 in 2011, and $500,000 in 2012 through a Canadian foundation called the Fernwood Foundation. The Clinton campaign left it to the foundation to reply to those questions about the Fernwood donations, but the foundation did not provide a response. Fernwood's undisclosed donations came in addition to roughly $5 million in contributions which were reported from a gaggle of people with ties to Uranium One's most valuable asset, the Kazakh mines. Without those assets, the Russians would have had no interest in the deal, that's for sure, he said, positive of his assertion. As if this was not enough, Mr. Bill was invited to speak in Moscow in June of 2010, the same month Rosatom struck its deal for a majority stake in Uranium One. The whopping $500,000 speaking fee was paid by the Russian investment Renaissance Capital. "It looks to me like they played the role of market maker," surmised Boris as he picked up his begging cat "It looks to me like they played the role of market maker," surmised Boris as he picked up his begging orange tabby. "Did you know Renaissance Capital turned up that same year as a major donor, along with Mr. Jurista and his buddies down at Uranium One, to a small medical charity in Colorado run by a friend of Mr. Jurista?" His cat only purred agreement and closed his eyes to narrow slits. "I'll bet no transcript of Clinton's speech exists anywhere for his boring speech, but Mr. Putin personally thanked Bill Clinton for speaking anyway," he said, putting the cat back on the hardwood floor. It was clear to Boris that the Clintons were influenced for huge amounts of money. It was no wonder the American public was ready and looking for an alternative to the one-party system that had nearly completed a most diabolical plan. Unopposed. He recalled the war between the FBI and the Department of Justice before and after the election. They had uncovered billions in laundered drug money and millions more in influence peddling after anonymous hackers sent them thousands of emails with documents that had been hacked from the Clintons' private server by foreign cyber thieves. It was like pennies from heaven, the agents commented after years of trying to subpoena them from various federal agencies. We have suspicions, but no facts could be found, said the cyber warfare agency on Fox News. Then all of a sudden we were gifted the proof from an outside source that had hacked the Clinton server years ago. Boris chuckled as he noticed the pattern of betrayal. How could anyone ever trust these guys again? He asked the computer screen. Still, I guess greed can blind even the smartest person, he mused as he took a deep whiff of his spicy meat, held his breath, downed another shot of vodka. He exhaled through his mouth and put the meat on his tongue and began chewing. Kazakhs don't really know how to drink vodka, he said,